Fritz Rocks Block. That right there is, that's Tommy James live. So, every indication that, man, the magical voice of Tommy James hasn't left at all. That was from 2002. Tommy James, Greatest Hits Live, and that was Sweet Cherry Wine. Before that, some studio stuff. We gave you Moni Moni, also the immortal classic, Crimson and Clover. And we also did Hanky Panky. There's quite a story about Hanky Panky. And we also gave you a rare track, a bonus cut, called Long Ponytail. And that was released on the 40-year anniversary the entire singles collection, the Tommy James and the Shondells 40 years, the complete singles collection from 66 to 2006. And maybe Tommy can tell us a little bit about Long Ponytail. We also heard I Think We're Alone Now. And you know that one, don't you? We also gave you a cut from 1990 called Go. And that was the first single that Tommy had gone back to work. And that was in 1990. And he can tell us a little bit about that. In fact, he starts off, the book telling about that story, about the song Go. And we also gave you Hanky Panky as well, way back there. No, actually, it wasn't Hanky Panky. You know what we gave you? We gave you Say I Am. That's what we started off the set with today, Say I Am. So there you have a nice set of Tommy James and the Shondells and some Tommy James stuff as well, and some live material. And joining us live on the telephone is the legendary Tommy James. Welcome to the show, Tommy.
Well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good, man. That was a nice set there. That put me in a festive mood.
That was a great intro.
Why, thank you very much.
Yeah.
And welcome to the show. Your manager, was Carol.
Yes.
Was kind enough to talked to me yesterday. And
she's great, isn't she?
She's terrific. Yeah, I can see why she's been working with you for over 20 years, right?
Right.
And she was kind enough to send up a few CDs, and also she sent up the book, Me, the Mob, and the Music, One Hell of a Ride with Tommy James and the Shondells. Now, we started off with Inside the Set here. I played the cut Go. So, there's so much, Tommy, that we can talk about. You know, the 100 million, record sales. You know, how many singles and gold albums and things like that. And we could go on and on about those things. But more importantly, let's talk a little bit about you, Tommy James, the man. How is your life today, right now?
Well, I'm a very happy guy. I truly am. I must tell you that, rock and roll lets you stay a kid for a long time. And I thank the good Lord and the fans for the kind of longevity we've had. This is a business that maybe gives you 2 or 3 years if you're lucky. And we've been doing this for 44 plus. And honestly, I couldn't have asked for a better job. And I'm a very happy guy. I truly am.
Your life is good today.
Things have been wonderful for a long time, and I must tell you that, for example, putting the book out now. I mean, just as a person, I feel so much better than I've ever felt in my life. But I also, putting the book out right now was very therapeutic.
I can imagine because of the tale that's within the pages of this book that it would be therapeutic to be able to talk after all these years.
That's
right?
Very true. This was a project that... really, and a story I've been waiting to tell for a very long time and never really felt that I could until now. We actually, Martin Fitzpatrick, my co-author, and I actually started the book almost 8 years ago. And we got about we were going to write a nice music book. We were going to call it Crimson and Clover and talk about the hits and writing songs and so forth. And it would have been very interesting, but we got about a third of the way into it and realized that if we don't tell the whole roulette story, and which really was the story, that we're really cheating ourselves and everybody else. But the problem was that some of these guys were still walking around. And I felt very uncomfortable talking about all this until finally the last of the roulette regulars, as I call them, passed away in 06, and I felt like we could finish the book, and we did. And the minute we finished it, we got gobbled up by Simon and Schuster, and they put out the book. It's in its sixth printing now, and I've never been an author, so I've been amazed at the reaction from the public and from the fans. And almost immediately after we released the book, we started getting calls for the movie rights, and so as it turned out, Barry Rosen and Mary Gleason are going to be the executive producers of the film. And over the next 2.5 years, it's going to get made. And then, all of a sudden, we got calls from the Niederlander family, who practically own Broadway, and they're bringing the story to Broadway. So I just am flabbergasted at all this, and how ironic that the biggest project that I've ever been involved in is going to be the retelling of this story. I just can't hardly believe it. So I'm extremely happy about all this.
Yeah, well, there's some very, very dark sides to the story. And
sure.
For the listener and for our reader out there who doesn't have the book and may pick up the book now, it's called Me, the Mob, and the Music, One Hell of a Ride with Tommy James and Nashawn Dells. You know, some of us that are in this industry, I certainly know who Morris Levy was, and I know about him. And I also know, you know, a little bit about Roulette Records, but to the fan out there,
right?
To the regular Joe or Mary on the street who may have been buying your singles back in the day and buying your albums in the day, they have no clue as to what kind of darkness
was
surrounding Roulette Records. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about that, so the listener knows what we're talking about.
Because certainly will.
It's a very dark, compelling tale.
Well, basically, the story, Me, the Mob, and the Music, is an autobiography, but about two-thirds of it is devoted to our very tumultuous and crazy and, in many cases, dangerous relationship with Roulette Records, because Roulette Records, as we found out after we signed, we learned this incrementally, of course, but Roulette Records, in addition to being a functioning record label, was also a front for the Genovese crime family in New York.
Ah.
And this made life really interesting. And, of course, our great challenge was trying to have a career in pop music with this very dark and sinister story going on behind us. And it affected us very, very much, because even though, of course, we weren't involved in what they were involved in, it was we were affected by the things that happened and the things they got involved in. And, you know, it was a constant walking on eggshells. A roulette was used as everything from a social club where these guys would hang out to money laundering and God only knows what went on up there, illegal bank accounts and things like that. So, you know, virtually none of the fans knew anything about this, and I really couldn't tell this story until now. And so, you know, we would, for example, when we first were selling Hanky Panky, you know, our first hit record, Hanky Panky exploded out of Pittsburgh very unexpectedly in 1966.
But you had recorded it two years earlier.
Right, 2 years earlier, back in my hometown of Niles, Michigan. I was still in high school. And I back in 64. And I the record, you know, went number one in about six square blocks and then died. And then we'd forgotten about the record, and then I graduated from high school in 65, took my band on the road, and we're playing a little joint in Janesville, Wisconsin.
And now you're like, what, 17, 18 years old?
I was 18. And right out of high school, and right in the middle of our 2 weeks, the club we were playing goes belly up. And I mean, the IRS shut him down, and we were lucky to get our equipment out of there.
Yeah, I'll say.
And so we had to limp back to Niles, Michigan, feeling like failures. But that's how the good Lord works, because as soon as we got back to Niles, I got a call from Pittsburgh that Hanky Panky had been bootlegged. They sold 80,000 of them in 10 days, and we were sitting at number one. And I went, what?
What a great story.
One of those, you talk about an Only in America story.
Exactly. What a great story, man.
And I'm not even sure that could happen anymore. So I went to Pittsburgh with the original record producer, who was Jack Douglas, was a DJ in Niles. And got there, and of course I had no group because I couldn't put the original bunch back together, so I sort of grabbed the first bar band I could find in Pittsburgh, and they became the Shondells, and we headed for New York to sell the master. So we get to New York, and by this is April of 66, and we get there, and boy, since we had a regional breakout in the trades, all the record companies wanted to do business.
Yeah.
We got a yes from Columbia, RCA, Atlantic, Kamasutra. Remember Kamasutra?
Oh, sure, of course I remember
and,
that.
So we were thrilled. And the last place we took the record to was Roulette.
And, you know, those are all majors, too. You know,
yeah.
Those are all the big boys,
yep,
there.
Yeah, those were the big players.
You know?
So, you know, I'm feeling great. We're staying in Midtown Manhattan, and I go to bed feeling wonderful. And the next morning, all the record companies call up one by one and say, listen, we got to pass.
Now that just sent a warning signal there.
And right? I said, what do you mean you got to
pass?
I thought we had a deal.
Yeah.
And so Jerry Wexler at Atlantic levels with us and tells us that Morris Levy, the head of Roulette Records, had called all the record companies and told them, this is my record.
Yeah.
Back off. And they did and scared everybody. And we were apparently going to be on Roulette Records.
you didn't have a choice in
no,
that.
No, an offer we couldn't refuse.
Literally.
Yeah, and so that, quite truthfully, was the way we ended up on Roulette Records. And, you know, once we got there, things started happening. You know, first of all, the record went number one, of course, all over the country and all over the world.
Yeah.
But we started realizing who we were rubbing shoulders with.
Yeah. You didn't know at first.
Yeah, no, right. And we'd meet somebody in Morris' office and shake hands, and a week later we'd see him, you know, being hauled out of a warehouse in New Jersey in handcuffs on TV, with bent noses and funny sounding nicknames. And we realized, I said, isn't that the guy that we just met up at Morris's office?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so this kept happening. And finally, we got a full blast. We realized who we were doing business with. And so it was a pretty scary place to be.
Well, was there pressure on you from Morris and from the label? Was there, you know, any kind of exerted pressure on you to write hits,
well,
to,
definitely,
to make,
but you know,
the records.
Funny, absolutely, there was, and I mean, there was. That became our life, is, you know, getting the next single in the can. But you know, if we hadn't been pushed, we probably wouldn't have had all the hits. You know, the funny thing is, as I look back, although doing business was a total disaster, I mean, mm-hmm. You just weren't going to get your mechanical royalties; it just wasn't going to happen. But if we had been with any other label, mm-hmm. if we had gone with, you know, one of the corporate labels, Columbia or Epic or RCA,
mm-hmm.
I can tell you what would have happened. We would, especially with a record like Hanky Panky, we would have been handed an in-house producer.
Right.
We would have got lost in the numbers, and probably that would have been the last time anybody heard from us.
Okay.
You know, we would have been a one-hit wonder.
Yeah.
And but at Roulette, they needed us. You know, they were a record company, and they hadn't had a hit in 3 years, and a big hit.
And they had some people on their roster, too.
Oh.
Wasn't Sammy Davis on the roster or was that later?
Yeah, they had a lot of, you know, great jazz people.
Great jazz people, yeah.
But, you know, they started out with Buddy Knox, Jimmy Bowen, Jimmy Rogers,
mm-hmm.
Joey D and the Starlighters and the Essex. And I mean, and of course, Morris was Alan Freed's manager, the great disc jockey.
Right.
He had started the club Birdland, the
Birdland.
Most famous jazz club in the world.
Mm-hmm.
He was partners with George Goldner, who created doo-wop, you know, Little Anthony and the Imperials.
Imperials, yeah.
And Flamingos and the Chantels. And so, you know, by the time Morris was like 40 years old, he was
a giant,
and quite literally. And
yeah.
So if at Roulette, they actually needed us, and they left us alone in the studio and allowed us to sort of morph into whatever we could become.
Mm-hmm.
And that wouldn't have happened anywhere else. I would have never got the education that I got anywhere else. And that's the truth. So in a funny way, I owe Morris a lot, you know.
Yeah.
So there was always this almost schizophrenic reality going on up there that you know, if it wasn't for Morris Levy, there wouldn't have been a Tommy James, and that's the truth.
Yeah. And on the flip side of that was, you know, you had to perform, so you had this pressure to write, and, you know, it actually helped you.
It actually helped.
As an artist, which...
It sure did.
You know?
So, I mean, isn't that what... Plus, I get to tell this story.
Yeah.
You know?
But you couldn't tell the story back then.
No,
I mean,
were
you actually, you know... when was the point when you realized that, or, you know, things came to a head for you?
They sure did.
You know, at some point, I mean... When we look back at that time, there were many artists that were you know, being ripped off, and it went on for many, many years. But there were also some people in the business who were very good people in the business who were really taking care of the artists as well, making sure that the artists got what they deserved. But
well, that's true. You know,
there were some good. We don't want to, you know, taint the whole entire industry back then, but we know that there were some heavy hitters, and there were some good guys. And you just happened to end up with a group of guys that included some heavy, heavy Genovese family hitters. We're not talking about
some heavy mobsters.
Yeah, we're not talking about soldiers here. You
no.
know, we're talking about
the heads of the family.
The heads of the family.
Yeah, and names you'd all recognize.
Yeah,
yeah,
which are in the book, by the way. There's pictures of some of the guys.
Pretty bad when the only shots you can find of your record company executives are mugshots.
Are mugshots, yeah. That's kind of scary, man. I don't know. Somehow I have this picture in my head, okay, that you guys are in the studio. You're hammering something out. It's just not working. And Morris is in the other room screaming and yelling. And somebody comes in and says, you know, you tell those boys we get something in the can by the end of the week or someone's going to have a bullet in the back of the head. You know?
Well, it wasn't quite that heavy, but it was close. I'll tell you the truth. There were some very, very scary moments up there.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of them was later on in 71 when there was a gang war that broke out in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm just going to say it.
I think it was the Gambinos.
The Gambinos were taking over the New York City.
New York City, yeah.
Morris was on the wrong side.
Yeah.
And he and Nate McCalla, who was Calla Records, but also his enforcer, headed for Spain and left me hanging there with the record company. Like, what am I going to do?
Oh, man.
And my lawyer called me up and said, listen, you know, it's quite likely if they can't get Morris that they're going to go after whoever's making Morris money, and that's you.
That's you.
I suggest you leave town for a few weeks. And I said, oh, great, I'm on the lam. Isn't that wonderful? So I end up going to Nashville with Elvis's guys, Scotty Moore and DJ Fontana. We made an album, about the best album I ever made up to that point. And, you know, that's just kind of how it was. In the midst, you know, all this angst going on in the middle of having hit records. And
yeah.
It was just so weird. And
Very weird.
And so anyway, I'm so glad that I get to tell it all now. And so anyway, it's going to be a movie and a Broadway show, and I just am so amazed that this is all happening right now. Right in the middle of our concert schedule.
In the middle of the concert schedule. Well, that's a good thing, though, you know. And, you know, it's an important story. Obviously, you know, there's enough drama in this story. It sounds like it has to be a film, you know, because it sounds almost too hard to believe that, you know, this kind of stuff was really going on.
Sure.
And at times, you know, you were on the lam and fearful of your life. But when did you realize that, you know, we're making hits here left and right. We're playing the sold out stadiums across the country. You know, people can't get enough of what we're doing, but yet we're broke. And, you know,
I can't say we were broke. What would happen was, and the reason I can be sort of magnanimous about it is because we were making money from many other sources, of course. We were touring. We were making money from...
merchandise? Were you getting your merch?
Merchandise and BMI and... also,
well, you can be thankful
doing.
For BMI all these years.
Sure, absolutely. But what we weren't getting was mechanical royalties from
the record sales,
from the record sales, and from the publishing.
And well, did they eventually own all of the publishing rights to the material?
They owned the publishing rights. It was all cross collateralized up there, and
wow.
So getting your money was like taking a bone from a Doberman. It just wasn't going to happen. And but we were having such success that, you know, I constantly had to, you know, this was a constant decision that I had to make, whether to take my life in my hands and take him to court,
right,
try to get out of this thing,
right,
or go along with things and just let things, you know, make a deal with the devil. And I that's kind of what we did. And I, in the end, I think we made the right decision.
You did eventually get out of it, though,
yes,
right?
Well, I left. I finally left in the middle 70s. I'd been there for almost 10 years, but I, you know, I had,
how'd
to,
you get
I had
away?
To leave publishing there. I had, there was, you know, until 19, I wasn't completely free really until 1980. And then Morris and I stayed, believe it or not, we stayed friends, if that's what you want to call it.
Well, let's just say you stayed.
Until he died in 1990. You know, he was finally convicted of racketeering.
You were probably, I would say, you remained polite friends.
Yes, we did.
Know, and kept it that way.
Yeah.
Because he knew that you knew exactly what went on. And
he actually offered me a record label in 1986 that I came very close to taking, but then in the end we couldn't, you know, he wouldn't allow anybody to he wouldn't allow us to
control
our own money. So I said, you know, maybe this isn't such a good idea. And it's a good thing we did, because right at that moment the feds got him.
Wow.
And what we found out, this is a little interesting story.
Yeah.
In Morris's office there was a sign, and had a nasty word, but oh Lord, give me a with talent, and was the sign.
Uh-huh.
And in the O of the word Lord,
yeah,
the feds had put a microphone and a camera.
Oh wow!
And we're watching the office and taping everything.
Oh wow!
And so it's a good thing I didn't do the label.
Yeah.
And undoubtedly, our, you know, that's how they finally nailed him. And so I was very thankful I didn't do that, because that's when the surveillance was going on, when I was being offered the label. The other thing was he finally, you know, he got cancer before he could go to prison. He was convicted of racketeering and extortion and all kinds of stuff, which were actually the lesser things that he ever did.
Yeah.
Sentenced to 10 years in prison. This was 1988, and before he could go to prison in 1990, he passed away, and his death is sort of the beginning and the end of the book. And you know, it's really amazing, because you know, the original Sean Dells and I are back in the studio making some music for the movie.
Oh, that's good to hear.
And one of the songs that we did was this very new version of I Think We're Alone Now, which was nothing like the original record. It was slow, acoustic, no drums, very ethereal, and it's going to be used as closing credits for the movie. And the reason I'm bringing that up is because the last scene in the movie, of course, is where Morris dies.
Dies, yeah.
And I Think We're Alone Now. You know?
Oh,
and
yeah.
So it completely changes the meaning of the lyrics.
Of the lyrics, it sure does.
So, you know, it's there's so many angles to this thing, and I just am sort of like a frog in a hailstorm
watching all this happen.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? It's a good thing though, right now. You know,
it really
because
is,
you know, you really at times through your career, it was a very dangerous time for you.
There were some moments that we're very lucky to make it out of there in one piece.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And you know, here you are today, and your music.
But of course, Roulette sold 110 million
records. Right.
23 gold singles and 9 gold and platinum.
Golden platinum albums. That's,
so I, you know, it's like I, you know, God bless the crooks.
God bless the crooks. All right. However, things did come around. All good things come around.
Yep.
You know, and we can talk just a little bit about how your music has still remained part of our lives throughout the years, especially in television and film soundtracks. When I look at the soundtracks, and I've seen almost every one of these films, I'm like, oh, yeah, wow, that's right.
Well,
that was in there.
Well, we've been very lucky, yes. We honestly, We've had over 300 cover versions of our songs done by just all kinds of artists, you know, R.E.M. to Prince to Dolly Parton, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm very thankful for that. And secondly, the movies, the films that the songs have been in. And I just am really flattered when a young band thinks a quick way to a hit is to do one of our old songs. I think that's great. And, you know, we do probably 30, 40 dates a year across the United States. And I look out at our concert crowd now, and I literally see three generations of people. And it's quite remarkable to me.
You know, that's the magic of music, Tommy.
Really is, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the magic of music. That's the magic of what you've contributed with your art.
Well,
it's what you've given, you know, and it's what all of our artists are still doing.
Colleges.
Yeah, your manager, Carol, mentioned that. You can talk a little bit about that.
What we're doing is we're basically doing a seminar in the afternoon and then playing concert at night. And that's going to kick in next year. And we're doing NYU. We're going to be doing probably Rutgers and probably around the New York area. And then we're going to venture out on the road to do some of these things. And I must say that we've had a great response from colleges. You know, college radio is one of the last bastions of sanity and in the radio business.
That's true.
And I say that for a lot of reasons. Most of the terrestrial radio, satellite's been pretty good, but has really taken a nosedive. And college radio has been great. They've been great to us, but they've also been a great place to break new music.
Yeah.
And so.
And keep the old stuff alive.
That's
as
right.
Well, too.
That's right.
You know, I mean, you heard the set that I played there.
Sure.
You know, and by the way, we'll tell the listeners, you are listening to the number one preset in the Lehigh Valley, 91.3 FM, WLVR, Bethlehem. It's Lehigh University Radio blowing the dust off your speakers, talking with the legendary Tommy James on the Fritz Rock Show today. I'm AJ Fritz. So, she told me you were a fan of college radio.
Yeah.
In fact, you've got somebody working with your management team.
You know, the program director of North Carolina University's radio station came with us.
Yeah.
And his name is Kyle McCurry, and he really is an amazing talent and really knows the college radio business, which is a lot different than regular radio.
Oh, yes, it is.
You know, there's a lot of nooks and crannies nobody knows about, so he knew the language and the jargon and the people.
Yeah.
And so he has researched all kinds of college radio for us and has really been a tremendous help as we, explore avenues where we can hook up.
Well, I'll tell you what I'd like to do, Tommy, if it's all right with you, I'd like to go play some music and play a song or two, and if you could stay with us.
Sure.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the music itself.
Absolutely.
All right. I'll tell you what, we'll go here to one of my favorites. Your music is still alive and well here because we've got three or four of your particular catalog, three or four cuts that we keep in regular rotation in our automated playlists when staff isn't here or on our overnights. So your music still lives on here. And it was Kyle who contacted us.
Oh, really?
Yes.
That's great.
Yeah,
that's
he
great.
Reached out to us, and we talked, we chatted yesterday for a few minutes. And,
sure.
And found out a little bit about his story. So it's very encouraging to hear that that you're an educator, too. And we'll talk a little bit about that and the music, because I have a question about some of the things you did in Crimson and Clover. But,
sure.
But this one here, maybe you could tell me about this one when we come back.
Church Street Soul Revival.
That's right.
That's a song that I did with a group called Exile.
We'll talk about that when we come back.
Been waiting for your arrival. Yeah, come on, boy. Look over yonder. What do you see? The sun is rising, most definitely. A new day is coming. Ooh-hoo. People are changing. Ain't it beautiful? Ooh-hoo. Crystal blue persuasion. Better get ready. Gonna see. Look to your soul and open your mind. Maybe tomorrow, when he looks down on every green field in every town, all of his children in every nation.
Rocks, 91.3 FM, WLVR, Bethlehem. Tommy James and the Shondells there. Crystal Blue Persuasion. You know, it still raises the hair on the back of my neck after all these years. And before that, Church Street Soul Revival, a deeper cut from Tommy James and the Shondells. And we're glad to bring it to you here. And still on the line live with us is Tommy. So, Tommy.
Yes, sir.
You know what I'd really like to know is how did you do that phasing thing with the vocals in Crimson and Clover? How did you do that back
in the
60s?
Well, you know, it was almost like it was like a last minute thing.
Yeah.
We had done the record, of course, with my guitar amp that I used back then was an Ampeg Gemini 2, it was called,
okay,
in the studio. And it had the tremolo built into the amp.
Ah.
So we had been using that on the guitar, and I just, right at the very end, I said, you know, it's like, why can't we do this with the, I'd like to try this with the vocal, just, and we ran it, you know, it was a real bearskins and, you know, bearskin and knives, running it through the tremolo unit. We mic'd the amplifier, ran the vocals through the amplifier,
through the amp,
and mic'd it, ran it back into the board.
Yeah.
And that was it. And I said, wow, that's nuts. And we put it on the record, and it ended up being, you know, one of the, probably the most memorable signature sound on the record. So it became really important for us.
And you just thought, well, why not try it, huh?
It was a whim. It was, we had made the whole record in like 5.5 hours. You know, the funny part about Crimson and Clover is that next to Hanky Panky, it was probably the most important record we made.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is that Crimson and Clover allowed us to make that jump from AM top 40 singles to FM progressive album rock.
And that's what I wanted to get into, was that whole period of time, because you were riding that rail so long, as you know, with that singles hit, that AM 40, that top 40, that AM gold stuff is doing very well for you.
Yeah.
And then we got the Cream. We've got Sergeant Pepper's from the Beatles. We got Pet Sounds from the Beach Boys,
right.
You know? An album that really, Pet Sounds was what, you know, influenced the Beatles to give us Sergeant Pepper's.
Absolutely, absolutely.
You know?
It was an incredible moment of creativity. There were no rules.
Right.
And we were making them up as we went along. And I was so fortunate to have my head in the studio right at that moment and to be given such freedom by Roulette.
Yeah.
And it allowed us to really dig into, you know, to become whatever we could be. And honestly, we had a group of songwriters, musicians, engineers, studio guys around us that were, you know, everyone around us was creative. Jimmy Wisner, by the way, who was our arranger, he was sort of our George Martin, and he's still with me today.
Still with you, yeah.
And, you know, so anyway, it was a moment that we'll never have again, I'm afraid, because all the rules were being made up. And it went from I got an education I could have never gotten any other way, by everything from the creation of the writing of the song to the creation of the record to the, you know, the doing the artwork on the album to right into marketing at retail. Got this sweeping view of the record business, for the science of it, the technology, and also the marketing expertise and radio, the whole business of learning the radio business. And they all went together, and it was a multi-layered education that you just couldn't have gotten any other time.
And you also worked, when you were very young, in a record store, too.
Yeah. I got to know the trade papers when I was in high school. I was, you know, I've been doing this for a long time.
For a long time.
I've been doing this since I was 12 years old.
12 years old, exactly. You know, you picked up the guitar in 1957.
I was 9 years old.
That was the year I was born, brother.
Well, listen, this is an amazing, stretch. The good Lord had something in mind for me, and I just take it at that and do my best. But getting back to Crimson and Clover, I just wanted to say that we had gone out on the Hubert Humphrey campaign with Hubert Humphrey that year, starting in August, with the vice president.
Right.
And the reason I bring that up is because when we left on the campaign, you know, the acts that were the biggest on the radio were all singles acts. They were all, you know, when we left, it was us, the Rascals, Gary Puckett,
and the Union Gap,
the Association, you know, the Buckinghams.
Oh, yeah.
And when
the
I
Gentries,
got back,
all that stuff.
And when I got back 90 days later, the whole world had turned upside down. It was all album acts. It was Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Led Zeppelin, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Joe
Jimi Hendrix.
Yes. And so everything turned upside down, and we realized out on the campaign that if we were going to continue, we were going to have to sell albums. And Roulette had never really done that. You know, they'd been great at singles, but they sold their share, but they never really were a big album-selling label like Atlantic or CBS.
Yeah.
And so we had to burn our bridges and get, you know, no more producers. We were going to produce and write and play on all of our own records, and we were going to have to fill up 24 tracks instead of 4 tracks, mm-hmm. which is what happened during that. And all of a sudden, you know, this was going to be the criteria for staying in the business. And so many of our friends, basically ended right there. So, you know, there was this mass extinction of singles acts right there.
Yeah.
And there was just a handful of acts that were allowed to go on. And Crimson and Clover, thank God we were working on that at the time, because no other single that we ever worked on would have allowed us to make that jump from AM to FM in one shot.
In one shot, right.
So, that's why I say, plus it was our biggest selling single of all times. And so for so many reasons, Crimson and Clover was incredibly important for us.
And I had mentioned when we were listening to some of the tunes that recently I saw the performance on the Ed Sullivan Show of Crimson and Clover.
Right.
And I was like, wow, I know I saw it in 67 or 68. I know I saw it then, but to see it so many years later.
Yeah, well, you know.
How innovative it was back then.
Well, thank you. You know, it was funny, that show you're talking about was aired February of 69.
69, okay.
We did the first Sullivan Show. We did several of them, but that was the first. And, you know, Sullivan was so scary because if you messed up, your career could be over.
Yeah.
And,
was it because it was that powerful of a show?
Yeah, it was huge. It had a 70% rating, which means that, you know, like 140 million people were watching it.
Yeah.
And it was live.
No pressure there.
None. No pressure. So, and you know, they had this, you know, Bob Precht, the producer of The Sullivan Show, had this uncanny ability to pick the week that your record was peaking the week that you were on. And,
okay.
I want to take this guy to the racetrack many times. But
yeah,
at any rate, so I'm sitting. This is 1 week, Sunday night, 1 week before the first Sullivan Show. And I had just finished a tour with the Beach Boys. And two of the Beach Boys were in our room with the Shondells. We were at the Hyatt House. They called it the Riot House on Sunset Strip.
Okay.
And we're watching the Sullivan Show because we know he's going to announce us the next week for being on the show.
Yeah.
So we're watching, and he says, ladies and gentlemen, right here on our stage, next week for the youngsters, Tony Jones and the Spandells will be here. Tony Jones and the Spandells.
Tony Jones.
So if I wasn't scared before, I'm like terrified.
Terrified now, yeah.
So, you know, Mike Vail and the rest of the guys are on the floor laughing, and I'm going, oh my God.
Yeah.
Which means, number one, he never heard
you. Never heard of you.
Number two, he can't read. So we went back to New York and started rehearsing on Tuesday, and, you know, they rehearsed right straight through till Sunday night.
Oh, and, wow.
And it was awesome, really. But they wanted me to do Crimson and Clover live.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know that that's a train wreck waiting to happen.
Well, that's what I'm thinking.
You know, there's no way these guys are going to get the fade right.
Yeah.
And so finally, I threw a temper tantrum, and they let me do a lip sync.
Okay.
So that was number one. Number two was when we got done with the show. Done performing, I forgot, when you're the headlining act, you got to talk to Ed.
Okay.
Which was a challenge of its own. You
yeah.
never knew what was going to come out of
his mouth.
And he tipped a few backstage, believe me.
Oh,
so
I bet.
So he was in rare form by the end of the show.
Oh, wow.
So he finally got my name right. And, you know, Engelbert Humperdinck, he has no problem with. James, he can't pronounce.
He can't pronounce.
So he's at the end of the show, he goes, now, Tommy's horn over here. So the first thing he says to me is, now, Tommy, I understand you were born and raised in New York City. And I go, no, man. you know, it's like I tell him, no, I was born in Dayton, Ohio. Grew up in Niles, Michigan. Gave him every way to climb out of that tree, but he wouldn't take it either.
No.
Once again, born and raised in New York City, Tony Jones. There he is. So that was my first Ed Sullivan show. And went downhill from there.
Oh, man. Hey, who's going to play you in the film? Do you have any insight on that?
You know, or
do
you
have
a little bit.
Personal choices?
I'm the worst one to ask.
Personal choices, maybe?
Well, this is kind of above my pay scale, but all I can tell you is there's probably going to have to be two actors because of the amount of time involved.
No, that makes perfect sense.
And one of them is being seriously looked at as the older Tommy is Val Kilmer. And, you know, he did such a great job Jim Morrison.
Yeah, he did.
So, and he's a friend, and he's seriously being considered. That's all I know. That we're going to make an announcement in the next few weeks about the directors and cast and things like that, because I just flat out don't know yet. They're both the play and the movie are sort of going to be in development at the same time, but mm-hmm. because it takes so much longer to do a film, the Broadway show is probably going to be first.
Are you going to be involved with these projects as
a
technical advisor?
Oh, definitely.
Okay, good.
Because I'm probably the last surviving member that knows these guys talk.
Exactly. Knows the real deal. You lived it, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm glad to hear that you're going to be involved with the projects.
Very definitely. And by the way, we're really, I do mean this sincerely, we're really looking forward to playing there this Friday night. I mean, it's really, we're really looking forward to that. We just want to invite everybody to come on out and we're going to meet some people and sign all the stuff, and it's going to be fun.
Fantastic. Again, Tommy James is appearing at the Sands Casino, part of the Sands Concert Series, right down the street here in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And we're looking forward to meeting you. I am coming to the show.
Great. Don't be a stranger. Come up and say hi.
I will come up and say hello. And I want to thank you for giving us so much of your time today, Tommy. That was fantastic.
My pleasure. And thanks for having me. And you take care of yourself.
Oh,
I
will.
And I'll see you Friday night.
We'll see you Friday night. And could you hold the line for just a second here? Because what I'd like to do is, if you don't mind, maybe you can do an ID or something for us.
Oh, I'd be happy to, sure.
You know, so that we can continue playing your music and let them know that, you know what, you dig what we're doing
here,
too.
You made me an offer I couldn't refuse.
Okay, all right. I'll tell you what I'd like to do here is I'm going to go to the live album.
Okay.
And I'm going to play a couple of cuts here. In fact, we're going to go towards the end of the album here, the live album, Tommy James, The Greatest Hits Live. This was a great performance, by the way, Tommy.
Thank you very much.
What a great night at the Bitter End.
You know, the Bitter End nightclub in New York,
down
the village.
Yeah, and was this done in 2002? Because that's when it was pressed.
It was done, actually, a couple of years before that.
Wow, well.
And it was first out on BMG, and then it's going to be out now on Aura, our label. We're re-releasing it. And it'll be out. It'll be out very soon, as a matter of fact, for Christmas.
Oh, fantastic! And you have a Christmas album too.
Yep, we've got the Christmas album. Is going to be. This is the second year it's been out, and it's going to be. We're very proud of that album.
You know what? I was very thankful to see this because what we do here at WLVR, Tommy, you'll be glad to know this. Mm-hmm. What we do is for the holidays, we celebrate the holidays. And we go into automation, we take all of our staff off the air, and
sure.
we do a Christmas holiday mix.
Yeah.
But it's not your traditional Christmas thing.
Uh-huh.
You'll hear everything from Twisted Sister and Heavy Metal Christmas and Bob Rivers to Mitch Miller.
Wow.
Okay, so it's a wide
variety.
You
really do Christmas.
Yes, and we also celebrate Hanukkah, the Jewish holidays,
uh-huh.
and put Jewish artists in there as well. And we really have a great time with it, and the people love it. And I did not have this, so we want you to know that the Tommy James I Love Christmas album, we will also include that in our rotation
well,
for the holidays,
thank
man.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
All right, so I think that'll be pretty cool. You know?
That's wonderful.
All
it
right.
Really is.
Well, I'll tell you what. We'll play some more live stuff here, and then we'll wrap up. And again, I got to say thank you so much for the most important part of this, Tommy.
Oh, my pleasure. Really, thanks for having me. I do appreciate it.
Thanks for
you
the music.
You still want to do the liner?
Yeah.
Okay,
just,
you got it.
You stay with me. All right.
All right.
Here's more Tommy James live at the Bitter End. I'll give you a little taste of what you might see live at the Sands Casino on Friday night. Stay with me, Tommy.
You're gonna
Hi, this is Tommy James, and you're listening to Fritz Rocks on 91.3 FM WLVR in Bethlehem.
You can't laugh, you can't cry. You're acting kind of funny and you don't know why. Cause your heart keeps beating like a big bass drum, and the beat's getting stronger and it's so much fun. And you keep on singing but the words are wrong, and you can't stop laughing, baby, what's going on?
It's only love trying to get through. It's only love trying to get through. It's only love trying to get through.
You can't run, you can't hide. No matter what you do, you're on a 10-cent ride. Going up, down, baby, and it's so much fun. And your heart keeps beating like a big bass drum. And the beat's getting stronger and it just won't quit. Better hold on, baby, cause you know that it's
all love trying to get through. It's all love trying to get through. It's all love trying to get through.
Fritz Rocks, 91.3 FM, WLVR, Bethlehem. Tommy James and the Shondells there, It's Only Love. We also give you Mirage and Moni Moni, the reprise. That coming from Tommy James and the Shondells, Greatest Hits Live, recorded live at the Bitter End, recorded in 99. And I just saw some stuff on YouTube with Tommy. Performances from 2008, man. The voice is still so, so sweet. Great stuff. He sounds amazing. And Tommy James will be entertaining us right here at the Sands as part of the Sands Casino Concert Series Friday night. We also gave you Crystal Blue Persuasion back there as well. So it is now 5:33 at your number one preset, 91.3 FM WLVR in Bethlehem. You've been listening to the Wednesday edition of the Fritz Rock Show. I'm AJ Fritz. Thanks for joining me. Thanks to Tommy James. And yeah, you really got to get this book. It's called Me, the Mob, and the Music, One Hell of a Ride with Tommy James and the Shondells. Written by Tommy James, it's printed by Simon & Schuster. It's out there in stores now. A great tale in the story of rock and pop and some of the seedier side of life that that Tommy went through. And, you know, there's a guy that went through some real hard times. He didn't really talk much about it, but you know what? They stole millions from Tommy. He didn't even really talk about it. He didn't even mention it. But they stole millions, estimated between $30 and $40 million they stole from Tommy back in the day. So if he's getting his end now through BMI, through airplay, through concerts and through films and so forth, then more power to him. We're glad to see that. And you can actually buy a DVD of the Tommy James performance live at the Bitter End. You can find all that all at TommyJamesMusic.com. The link is on our website at WLVR.org. You can find out more there as well. All right. Now, what are we going to go to? We want to remind you, please buckle up for safety's sake. Don't drink and drive, and no texting while driving, please. The life you save may be mine. So be careful. I'm getting a little froggy now.
We'll be right back. in Central Park, or the lion hunter in the jungle dark, or the Chinese dentist, or the British queen. They are fit together in the same machine. Oh, a whirling dervish and a dancing bear, or a ginger rajah's and a Fred Astaire, or the teenage rocker, or the girls in France. Yes, we all are partners in this cosmic dance. We'll be right back.
city.